It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The more we go online, the harder it is to protect our privacy. But it can be done. Data Privacy Day is an international effort to educate people on how to protect their privacy and control their digital footprint. A series of events on this topic will be taking place later this week at Carnegie Mellon University, which is holding an International Privacy Day celebration on Thursday. The event will feature a privacy clinic where attendees can learn how to better protect their data privacy. Joining us to address how we can protect our privacy as our interaction with computers increases is Jason Hong. He's associate professor at the Human-Computer Interaction Institute at Carnegie Mellon. Jason Hong, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. What questions do you have about how to protect your privacy, particularly if you are active online? 412-246-2002 is the number to call to join the conversation with a question or comment. Jason Hong, first let's talk about this event, the International Privacy Day celebration on Thursday. What's happening at this?
Well, the main goal of the event is to help raise people's awareness of the privacy issues that are going on, as well as the great work that's going on at Carnegie Mellon University. So some of the specifics that we're going to have is Ed Felton. He's the current chief technology officer for the United States. He's going to be doing a keynote presentation. And there's also going to be the clinic, as you mentioned, where we can help people with privacy. And also a poster session where people can see all the different kinds of things that are going on right now at Carnegie Mellon for privacy.
Okay, so and when you say awareness of what exactly? What are people not aware of? And I guess one of the big things is how you compromise your information when you are active online.
So for awareness, there's a lot of data that's being collected about us, and most people don't know about it. So for example, every time you go out on the web, every time you use one of these smartphone apps, they're all collecting data about us. And most of the time, they're trying to use it for good purposes, but sometimes people are very surprised to learn that this data is being collected at all.
People are not, even with all of the discussion about this, there are a lot of people that they go online or they're using some app on their iPhone, responding to something, and all of a sudden, whoop, my information's out there. How did that happen?
Yeah, I've given talks at Silicon Valley companies before, and even they were surprised at the results that we had about all these smartphone apps and the data that was being collected. I've had lots of people come up to me afterwards at these talks and told me that they deleted the apps during the talk because they were so surprised that their location data or unique phone ID was being collected.
Boy, when the people in Silicon Valley are surprised, then you know that there's a lack of understanding about this.
Right, and that's one of the challenges with privacy is that often it's very hidden. And usually the people who are collecting the data aren't malicious, but it's very surprising to people that it's being collected at all, and it can also make people very uncomfortable about it.
Well, and the people that are collecting the data may not be malicious, but maybe they're not being careful enough about keeping it out of the hands of other people who might be malicious.
Right, that's right. And so it might actually be all these kinds of data leaks that we've been seeing too. But it also goes beyond that because privacy is really all of our relationships with all the other people that are out there. So we've been focusing a lot on the corporate versions of the privacy and the data that's being collected. But, you know, sometimes you might also have other family members that might be getting information about you and you might not want it. They might be reading your blogs, they might be, you know, your Facebook friend, and they might be able to see more data about you than you realized.
Other family members?
It could be family members, friends, coworkers, places you work at, people at your church. It can be all of that, too.
People that you would be mortified to know are looking at, you know, something you posted somewhere about some aspect of your life.
Right. And so this is often one of the big problems with privacy is that there's a mismatch between what people think is being shared and what's actually being shared.
Should we just assume that something that you want to believe is going to stay private, or that you are assuming is only being shared with the people that you are intending to share it with, that is not generally not the case?
Right. A general rule of thumb that we give people is to don't share anything that you would be embarrassed to see on the front page of a newspaper. Because if you are doing that, then, you know, there is always a risk that it could be accidentally shared or even maliciously so, too.
I don't mean to laugh, but it just seems that what do you do? What you just said is a very good piece of advice. So you can't share it online. And, you know, there are the conspiracy theorists that think, well, we can't even have a conversation. Somebody's listening. There's a drone. There's a mic pointed. There's a camera somewhere. Like, where do you go to have a private conversation anymore, Jason?
Well, there are some secure rooms where you can do that. But, you know, for the most part, it's really a risk assessment, too. We're trying to raise the people's awareness of all these different kinds of issues and so that we can make better decisions as an entire community and an entire population of people.
What is rich sensor data?
So rich sensor data is... There's a lot of sensor data that's coming out on all the devices that we have. So people who are wearing Fitbits, they're having their steps monitored and perhaps their location. People who use smartphones, they can collect the microphone data, your unique phone ID, your location. So basically, there's so much sensors that are coming out these days. It's called the Internet of Things, where it's really the third wave of computing. The first wave of computing was looking at what computers could do themselves. The second wave of computing was about networking all these computers together. And now we're just in the earliest parts of this third stage of computing, the third wave of computing, where computers are becoming part of our everyday world, where they can sense what's going on around us, and they can also start changing parts of the world too, like actuating. So a really great example would be driverless cars, where the cars can sense all the things that are around them and also can maneuver too.
Are there things that we can do? Are we relying too much? Like when you talk about the app, that measures the steps when we walk or run. A lot of people use that to measure the distance of their jogging or whatever. So you're saying that through that, somebody could latch onto that, or I guess leech might be a better word, and go, Jason Hong is walking from or jogging from CMU down to the Cathedral of Learning and back, and I can watch him do that. Right.
Well, so it depends on what the security precautions are for these kinds of devices. Some of them we've analyzed have really good security protections. Some of them don't. And so if a malicious hacker really wanted to get some of the data, they could really do this. But it really depends on the specific app or device. It's hard to make a general kind of blanket argument for all of them.
So I guess what I'm asking is, are people just too into doing the thing that's attached to their iPhone as opposed to what if you just attached a regular old pedometer to your belt, and then you wouldn't have to worry about that.
Right, and you could do that. And there's a lot of these technologies that are offline like that. This is really the fundamental tension with privacy, which is that on the one hand, all the data that we're collecting can have a lot of benefit for ourselves and for society in terms of things like sustainability, transportation, and healthcare. But on the other hand, they can also be accidentally leaked, or they might also be used in ways that we don't want too. So one of the best examples of this was reported by the New York Times a few years ago, was Target. Target, the company, the store, was trying to use the data to see if they could predict who was likely to be pregnant. And if they were, then they could start sending a lot more coupons that way so that they could start buying more stuff for kids. So on the one hand, this is actually very effective. You know, economists would say it's very good because it streamlined all the transactions. But then the incident was that a father found out that his daughter was pregnant through these coupons.
We're talking with Jason Hong, associate professor at the Human-Computer Interaction Institute at Carnegie Mellon, about International Privacy Day and what you can do to simply secure your privacy if you go online quite a bit, as many people do. And I was going to bring up something that I got texted on, and I'm wondering how people got this information. Is this a good thing to bring up, you think?
Well, is it a good question?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm just wondering how I frequented a certain fast food restaurant, or I used to more than I would today. And they, I will not reveal the name of the restaurant, but they texted me, "We miss you at blank. Visit us by February 1st and redeem free beverage or $1 off purchase." You know, I'm thinking, and it says redeem after checking in at iPad. I'm thinking, how do they even know how to reach me? I don't remember ever giving them my number. What's going on here, Jason?
Odds are high that maybe they had purchased it somewhere, or maybe that you had shared it and just forgot. Or if you installed an app, it might be the case that your app might be sharing that phone number too.
I think that's what's going on here. It just happened this morning, and it's kind of weird. So how can we make privacy and security easy, especially for someone like me who's just not, I mean, I'm as guilty as anybody of not taking the proper precautions, I'm sure.
I think the best way of doing this is to look at the whole ecosystem and figure out the best points of leverage for all of those. So, for example, for smartphone apps, we have the smartphone developers. So this might include Samsung and LG. You have the operating system. So that's Apple and Google. You also have the app developers. And you know, in our past research, in our interviews and surveys with developers, we found that many of them don't know what to do about privacy at all. So that would be a really great place to try to improve things. And then there's also consumer advocates like Consumer Reports, the Federal Trade Commission, and also these organizations that are devoted to privacy. And so there's lots of different kinds of ways of trying to improve privacy that don't have to push all the burden on the end users themselves, because that's currently what the current state of affairs is that you as a consumer have to manage everything about your privacy, and it just becomes too much of a pain to try to manage.
Well, yeah, virtually impossible if, you know, just in terms of a, you know, efficient time management perspective. How can we use crowdsourcing to improve privacy and security?
Right. So the basic idea behind crowdsourcing is that you can have lots of people do the work for you. So an example of this is Amazon Mechanical Turk. It's a really great website where you can have small micro tasks and you can farm it out to lots of people who have a little bit of spare time, and you pay them just a few cents to answer some simple questions. We've been using a lot of crowdsourcing in our research to try to analyze these apps and help people make these decisions too. So, for example, if 80% of people say that it's really unusual for a motorcycling game to use location data, then the odds are high that you probably don't want to use it too.
And if we identified the populations that are the most vulnerable when it comes to privacy?
Yeah, I think that it's really hard to answer at this point because there haven't been great studies on it. But what we have seen in the past is that younger people tend to share a lot more data and are a lot more susceptible to these kinds of attacks, to falling for scams and so on. Older people might also have a fear of technology and don't quite understand what's going on. So it's a little bit hard to say with a precise answer, but there do seem to be some kinds of demographic differences.
Mm. And tell us about what you will be covering at this Privacy Day event, which again is happening on Thursday, an International Privacy Day celebration at CMU.
Right. So we'll be having a keynote speaker. It's Ed Felton. He's the Chief Technology Officer of the United States. He's the first one ever that we've had. So he'll be talking a lot about these privacy issues. He's been an advocate for privacy and has been studying this area for many, many years. Then we're also going to have a clinic where people can bring in their questions, or if they have, you know, apps that they're developing, they can also ask about advice for that. And then we're also going to have a poster session where people can also see all the ongoing research that's going on at Carnegie Mellon University. So one of the ones that we'll be presenting is our website called privacygrade.org, where we've analyzed the privacy of a million smartphone apps.
We're talking with Jason Hong, Associate Professor of the Human-Computer Interaction Institute at Carnegie Mellon, 412-246-2002, to join the conversation. Let's go to Eric in Pittsburgh. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, sir. You're on with Jason Hong.
Here's my question. Back since the original Unix days, there's been the ability, and in fact, it was always done, where when you typed in your password, they would scramble it and store it scrambled, and then the next time you log in, they would just compare the scrambled versions. So if you've got the scramble side, you got nothing, essentially. My question is, since this has been around for so long, that if someone this has a data breach like Target, why is anyone able to get plain passwords out of there, unencrypted data, in other words? Why is that? How is it possible that they're storing it in a way that is still useful to someone who steals it?
Yeah, that's a great question. The basic answer is that the developers and the engineers just didn't know what they were doing. And it's partly a tools issue because the tools don't necessarily make it easy to always just store the password in the hashed format, the basically scrambled format that you're mentioning. But it's also an educational issue. Right now, there's not a lot of people who are trained in computer security. And so I think it's around 60% of people who are doing programming today don't have a college degree. And so most of the people out there just have no experience at all with computer security. And that's one of the big problems that we're facing.
Eric, thank you for that phone call. That's probably an example of the type of questions that will come up on Thursday. You'll get, I'm guessing a lot of people will be approaching you to pick your brain.
Yes. Well, we hope so.
We've been talking with Jason Hong. He's Associate Professor at the Human Computer Interaction Institute at Carnegie Mellon, and he is going to be presiding, among those presiding over International Privacy Day, a celebration on Thursday at CMU. It sounds very interesting. Thanks for coming in to share some of the information about that.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, in an age when so many people and companies are online, what's the best way to tell your story? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.